My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we dive back into the world of Bigfoot with my guest, Daniel Perez. Daniel has 5 decades of experience in the field of cryptozoology and has been publishing the monthly Bigfoot Times for the last 22 years. From corresponding with John Green and René de Halden as a teenager, Daniel has built one of the most solid reputations in the field of cryptozoology today. We talk about a couple of classic cases, his love of cryptids and cryptozoology, the Bigfoot Times, and much more. So, before we dive into this week's show, firstly, after several months of frustration, 99% of the shows are now on YouTube. Hooray! I can't tell you how relieved I am to have finally got the majority of the shows up there now, and a big thanks to Chris Walker for helping me get that sorted. I've changed all the artwork, there's one episode left to go. So if you've got a YouTube subscription, please log on and subscribe to the channel. It's fully functional now. So thank you for everybody that's been waiting, because I think it was December the last time we had one automatically added. So I've updated every show that's been missing, going back all the way to Halloween. So I hope there's a few in there that you'll be able to rediscover. All right. Secondly, it's been quite a productive week. Had a great appearance on the Ghost Story Guys. So I've always got time to spend with Ian and Brennan. They've been massive stars and supporters of the show ever since I started. So hello to anybody that's found me from that show. I hope I didn't put you off too much. Clearly not, because you're here. So welcome, and I hope you look in the back catalogue and find some shows to your liking. There's a few spooky ones out there. And if you want any pointers, just drop us an email at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Don't forget, you can find the groups on Facebook. We are under Mystery Monsters on Twitter and Instagram, as well as the fully up-to-date YouTube channel, which I've already bored you with. And coming on the back of April was our best month by a mile. The show has just grown yet again, so thank you to every single one of you guys that keep listening to the show, keep sharing it, keep writing those nice reviews on your podcast app. It means the world to me to know that people are interested in enjoying the shows that I'm doing, and I will continue to do my very best for you. So I'd just like to say thank you to Rick, Emily, Steve, Sarah, Lisa, Belgan and Megan for their emails, reviews and kind comments this week. Don't forget, if you haven't left us a nice review on your podcast app, please do so. It all helps the show grow and reach new people. And I'd really appreciate 2 minutes of your time. So thank you in advance. So, here we are in May. Lockdown continues for most of us, no doubt. But I've got some top-notch guests coming up this month. With Daniel, I have 4 brand new guests appearing this month that have never been on the show before. 2 I've been trying to get on since the show started. So I hope you enjoy both of their interviews. And we've also got a returning guest, one of probably my top 3 most requested people that I've had on the show, so I hope you enjoy his return. And all I'll say is high strangeness is still continuing in East Yorkshire. Don't forget as well, you can always drop me a line at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. had some lovely emails this week, some more sickeningly fantastic pictures from people around the world hiking, listening to the show, so I really do appreciate that. So if you want to make me feel awful, please send me a picture on your email telling me where you're listening to the show. I'd really appreciate it, and I'm only jealous. It's just because I'm sat in a room during lockdown, that's all. If you've got any feedback, guest suggestions, or you'd like to appear, the email is the best way to get hold of us here. And that's all I've got to say before we join Daniel and immerse ourselves once again in the world of Bigfoot. Today, my guest is the noted Bigfoot investigator, author and publisher, Daniel Perez. Daniel has decades of research and knowledge in his locker and continues to publish the Bigfoot Times, now in its 22nd year of existence. We are delighted to welcome you to the show today, Daniel. How are we?
Well, in spite of the coronavirus, I think everything is okay. Yeah. And okay right now in the world is actually we're doing pretty good.
It certainly is a good place to be. I agree entirely for you. You've not had any sort of frightening incidents involving toilet paper or anything like that, Daniel? You've been all right?
Well, actually, here in the United States, when things first broke out, there was a run on water, toilet paper, wipes, and sanitizers. So, it's somewhat been restored, and I've been lucky to get enough to keep me going.
Good. So, and everybody in you and yours is looking after themselves and staying safe, Daniel?
As much as we can.
Great news. Good to hear. Right. Daniel, as I touched on in the introduction, you're someone I've known about for quite a while in the world of Bigfoot, and I touched on it there when I said that you've been responsible for releasing the wonderful Bigfoot Times for the last 22 years. But your sort of love affair with Bigfoot goes way back, even longer than the 90s. So how on earth did you find yourself immersed in all things cryptozoology?
I think it found me. I got interested by way of one single movie, which I credit my entire participation in all things Bigfoot. Mm. And that movie was called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which just about anyone who knows anything about Bigfoot knows that film. And I saw it at a walk-in theater in 1973. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And by that, I mean that they were presenting information in a serious tone. And I thought I was just going to see like a monster movie like Godzilla or something of that nature. Mm. And it really hit me to the point where I went to the library and I figured out what they were talking about. Mm. And started checking some books out. And again, the tone of the books from that time period were pretty serious. And I said, well, this is really interesting. And one thing led to another. And at the time, there were two today legendary deceased investigators, but at the time living, mm. Rene de Hinden and John Green, mm. that had addresses, postal addresses in their books, and I wrote to them, and they were kind enough to write back. So essentially, I linked up with the two of the most famous legendary Bigfooters of all time ever right out of the gate. So I was a protege of them.
Wow. I mean, that's some kind of introduction to it, because obviously Green and Renee are, as I touched on, in a couple of interviews, are known as the collective that was the Horsemen, Daniel.
Exactly. Who better to get linked up to right out of the gate? And so my introduction in my teens was, and I didn't know anything at the time whether who these people would eventually turn out to be until much later in life, because I had probably 30 years with both of them as colleagues before they passed on. And so that was, they are my mentors.
That's incredible. I mean, it is fascinating, I think, especially in regards to Rene, because I think once you get really into the subject of Bigfoot, and especially the explosion in exploration of Bigfoot in the sort of from the late 50s onwards, Daniel. You know, John and Renee are two of the people probably most you know, most responsible for pushing Bigfoot into the public consciousness.
I would agree 100%. And it's just like they were like the Johnny Appleseed of the day, in the sense that they spread this the gospel of Bigfoot, and people were very receptive. And look where the subject is today in terms of how many people are interested or participating in an active investigation.
Yeah. So were you fortunate enough? Obviously, I mean, that's the wonderful thing about these halcyon days when people would leave a postal address in their book, Daniel, and you could just write to them and say, "Hello, I've bought your book and I'd like to talk to you about it." And I, you know, and like you say there, I mean, absolute credit to them both to correspond with you and to build up that kind of relationship. So from that point onwards, Daniel, when was did you get the opportunity to be invited out to go investigating with them in the field?
I've been in the field with Rene de Hinden, but
Hmm.
it wasn't in any sense an investigation. That was on the heels of the Sasquatch Symposium in Canada. And we just drove out to the mountains. It wasn't like we were following up on anything. We were just
Yeah.
out looking around. So we were out in the field. But with John Green, myself, Tom Steinberg, the Canadian investigator, and John Green investigated, I forget the name of the individual's name. I think it's MacArthur or McDonald. McDonald's the name of the bear hunter who had a sighting. And I want to say that was 97. And we followed up in the sense that we went after the fact, we went to the location of where the sighting happened, and we scouted the area pretty thoroughly. We didn't find anything, but it was a very good, very remote area. I mean, it's just basically all wooded for miles and miles and miles. And of course, this is happening in British Columbia, that has a people population less than the entire state of California, but British Columbia is at least twice the size of the state of California.
I often find it surprising, Daniel, that people just don't realize how large and wooded British Columbia is. It's incredible.
Yeah, if you were to take the argument, if Bigfoot could be anywhere, that you could have Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, Ogopogo, and every cryptid in the world hiding out in that one province in Canada, and still be hidden. It's that big.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's got a couple of notable mentions in the annals of cryptozoology, as you touched on there, with Ogopogo popping up because, yeah, it's one of those states that I think is it's just ripe for mystery. It's like a throwback to a far off time.
Yes, in fact, when you go out there, it's almost like stepping in a time machine. And so some of the best reports are from British Columbia, from Albert Ostman, who claimed that he was kidnapped by a Sasquatch in 1924. And then you go to 1955, I believe, with William Rowe, who had a sighting. And again, that was in Tetuan Cachet, which is up in the mountains in British Columbia, if I'm pronouncing it properly. And I spoke with the family after he was deceased, and they just basically made a blanket statement. They said, "Well, if William said it was so, it's so. End of discussion. That this is what he claimed," and they ne never had any reason to doubt him ever.
Yeah.
And by the way. Me as an editor and publisher, I was the first person ever to publish William Rowe's image picture in any publication, and that publication just happened to be my Bigfoot Times newsletter, and that was several years ago. Prior to that, his picture had never been published in any book, magazine, or anything.
That's incredible. I mean, what? Because, like you said, you know, at the beginning there, you know, Boggy Creek was what pulled you in, and you started corresponding with Renee and John. You started writing about Bigfoot pretty early on. So was it sort of the late 70s you started that, Daniel, in regards to?
Yeah, In fact, that was the first incarnation of the newsletter. It was called Bigfoot Times with one T, one word, Bigfoot Times. And I started publishing that in my high school years, and I had access to a plug-in typewriter, I think, typewriter. And so that's how I launched the first newsletter. And that ran through about 1986, and then I stopped publishing. And then the second go around was with the kind of the advent of the laptop computer. Was January of 1998, I launched the Bigfoot Times, two words. And at the time, the late 90s, it was kind of the dawn age of the internet. And there were still a lot of published, mailed out postal newsletters on the topic from Washington State to Ohio, Florida, and parts in between. And so it was a little bit of a crowded field. And I said, you know, I'll throw my hat into the ring as well. And over two decades later, I prevailed. All of those newsletters are extinct, and there's only one published mailed out newsletter today, the Bigfoot Times.
Yeah, absolutely. Last man standing, Daniel.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm quite pleased by that.
Very much so. I mean, it's an interesting throwback because obviously here in the UK, we had a lot of sort of UFO groups in the 90s who kind of corresponded in the same kind of way. They would advertise in certain magazines that people would buy, Daniel, and they would get that. So essentially, was it like a pen pal communication where people would write in and request copies of newsletters and you would mail them out to them based on that?
No, it was, we just did a monthly newsletter, and it was news that I gathered through my studies and research, and not so much pen pals. You know, if there was any pen paling, it had to do with a letter to the editor that someone would make comments about certain articles, or they would write a letter stating that they had an experience, seen tracks, or had a sighting.
So did it, I mean, at the time, like you say, there was several things going on. Was it difficult to kind of get that, or had you sort of already built up a reputation, Daniel, where people knew they could come to you and be treated seriously?
Yeah, I think by then, at least within the Bigfoot community, I was starting to become pretty well known. And even today, I'm not out there looking for five stars. I'm trying to be low key. And that's just the way I go about things, because I don't think it's necessary to be, you know, out bright and shiny for everyone, you know, because it's an ongoing investigation, and that you don't necessarily need to be that person, because today in the age of the internet, you could spend the rest of your life from this point forward just researching the reports that are on the internet.
Do you think that the explosion in the modern era has muddied the waters somewhat, Daniel?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I think it's Tom Steinberg, the Canadian Sasquatch investigator. He said it has kind of made it, the internet and social media has kind of made it like a breeding ground for hoaxing. And oftentimes you could find this information or this data or suspected data on YouTube, like a person is claiming a sighting, but the first two things that you want to know are not there: the name of the person who shot the video and the location. And so those items are conveniently left out of the whole picture, because that's where the faking is involved. They don't want you to know who did it, and they don't want you to know the location, because naturally, if you could find the location, you could say like, oh, that thing in the film was not 9 feet tall. It was more like 5 feet tall. So the right there is the area that you go to immediately to say like, well, if there's not a name associated with a specific report, then just kind of back off. At least I do.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, at the end of the day, I've noticed it, especially More so in the last 10 years, YouTube being the prime example of a big melting pot of hoax footage is the probably the nicest way. There are, you know, notable individuals, and I'm not, you know, as I always say, I don't want to give anybody like that any credence, Daniel, that have made a reputation. I'm thinking of I believe he claims to be a vet, is one particular person who has frozen parts, he claims, which look...
I think I know who you're talking about. I've seen him on YouTube, and I think he has his whole presentation laced with profanity, and it's just... I'm not exactly certain what the motivation of these individuals are, other than maybe they're advertising for something else. Like in this case, it might be pet sitting or dog breeding or whatever the case might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people just used to leave a calling card in the shop for people to find them. And now they're resorting to this, Daniel. It's a strange age indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, do you... I mean, I try to, when I tackle this subject, because you know, I often battle with myself, primarily about the lack of physical evidence. But then I go back to certain things and I say, well, we have got certain aspects. And so I'm constantly, you know, 99% of the time I'm all in. And then occasionally I'll get a little voice of doubt just squirreling away at me, Daniel, as I'm sure anybody does who's got a love of a subject such as this.
Well... I've had those discussions with both Renee and John about the lack of physical evidence. And to them, because they were living in areas that were more easily connected to the woods than I am, because I live in Los Angeles, and you don't just drive out with your vehicle and go into the woods immediately. Mm. Where they live, you can do that.
Yeah.
So there's a difference there, but I asked them about the lack of physical evidence, and that really never presented the problem to them. Their comeback would be, it's just generally that you generally just do not see the carcasses of animals left in the woods of any nature. And that really is, there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. I mean, one of those perplexing arguments, Daniel, when the body question always gets brought up, because As far as I'm aware, sightings of creatures even as large as bears that have died of natural causes in woods are extremely rare. The majority of people that see a dead bear is because it's been shot.
Right, exactly. Myself and a colleague at the time, Justin Smeha, we went out to investigate his report, and I think this was around 2012, and we actually did see a dead bear, and it was on the road. And I think it wasn't shot, but I think someone hit it. And we pulled it off the highway. But to my memory, in fact, yeah, it's the only dead bear I've ever seen. But there was a case where a bear was trying to cross the road, and someone hit it, and it just died on the spot there. And we doubled back and pulled it off the road. And the only dead bear I've ever seen, and the cause of the death was obvious.
Yeah. And I always think it's one of those skeptical explanations that when you actually put that under some duress, Daniel, that doesn't stack up, like you say. I mean, how long have you been going out and investigating?
Not nearly as much as a lot of other people. But I have been out in the field quite a few times to follow up on information. And I've never really seen hardly anything. We did hike up in some mountains, a friend of mine, and this was probably in 2009. And we did find the remains of a bighorn sheep. We both kind of agreed that it was a mountain lion had got it, kind of. It almost got the impression that it was being tucked into like a little bit of a undercropping on rocks where it was hiding for further food at a later date. But when we got there, I don't recall seeing any tissue. It was just basically all bone, and it was just mostly the head portion of the body.
Yeah. So these are rare finds, even when we're talking about well-known species. That it's
Yeah.
in these areas, it's extremely difficult to come across any kind of corpse out there.
And one thing that would come to mind, because these things have the built on the same physical framework as Homo sapiens, is that there's always that distinct possibility that they bury their dead. And based on the data in terms of their behavior and intelligence, I wouldn't be surprised if this might be the exact behavior that they have, the exact behavior that they do with the deceased, that they bury them. And it wouldn't surprise me the least bit. And that might be part of the reason why we are not finding the physical evidence that we think we should.
I mean, for me, I don't think that's much of a stretch, to be honest, Daniel, because if we are supposed to take some of the best known cases into consideration, we are talking about a bipedal primate of some description that shows a level of intelligence to be able to communicate and use weapons. So that alone would suggest that we are talking about a level of intellect that would be above that of, say, a bear or a cougar. We are talking about animals that can react to our presence in certain circumstances intelligently.
Right, and I would agree 100%. It's just like you're dealing with a very intelligent species out there, and to what level I don't know, but one that's probably capable of having thought, reason, and cause and effect ideas that in their head, just like us.
Well, absolutely. And we only have to look at our knowledge of primates to see how quickly they can adapt and change their behaviours. Or we're only just discovering behaviours. Like, we've only recently discovered that orangutans will use sticks to go fishing, and other types of monkeys have been seen to use that. And we've examples of monkeys using stones as weapons. So why do we keep surprising ourselves by things that perhaps we should expect from these
Right.
intelligent
I
creatures?
think I think possibly the answer might lie in the fact that a lot of people are in denial.
Well, yeah, I think so, because it strikes me as peculiar, because when you look at some of the cases where we've got well-recorded interactions of a variety of situations, Daniel, the thing that strikes me is this is not the behavior of a wild animal,
Okay.
because they seem to be able to adapt and change and make themselves scarce when they need to, but be there's a level of cunning on display in some aspects of the
Yeah,
situations.
I would agree with that. And it's like all of a sudden there's a big wave of activity, say in the state of Ohio, for sake of argument, and all of a sudden there's all this tracks being recorded and stuff, and then once people start realizing they're trying to do something about this problem of these wild things or unknown things coming near their property or something, they try to do something and possibly shoot at these things, and all of a sudden these things pull a disappearing act and they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, it is often interesting that you will get a situation where there is a flap, as you touch on there, Daniel, for a couple of weeks, maybe a month or two, and then there's a flurry of excitement and people go there, and then it seems to just disappear.
Yeah, and that I think there could be a variety of reasons, and possibly perhaps one of the main reasons is that they have an instinct saying that their lives might be in danger, and let's just get out of this area. We've cased it for all we can get.
I mean, it is a perplexing situation, but like I say, I think it's only perplexing if you work on the principle that it's a wild animal and it's not intelligent. Whereas I think if you work on the principle of it clearly shows defined intellectual characteristics, then why wouldn't, as we started this long way around, Daniel, why would you? Why would they not show respect to their dead and bury them, or take them to a place out of sight?
Yeah, it seems like that could be the answer. But to my memory, I think maybe once in Ray Crow's newsletter, which Ray Crow is now deceased, but he published the Western Bigfoot Society Bigfoot newsletter. I forget exactly what it was called, but no longer being published, needless to say, because he's deceased. But he did discuss one report, and I think it's the only report I know of where someone had allegedly observed a group of Sasquatches that were burying one of their own, or at least that's the impression that the observer had. And I vaguely recall seeing it in his newsletter. And this was back in the 90s, and when the report happened, I'm not exactly certain when, but it's the only one that I know of.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, that is, it is striking, because often the potential to see a corpse, or for someone to claim that they have one, is usually an alarm bell for me, Daniel. I don't know about yourself, because I've seen so many stories where someone ends up claiming that they've got a part of it, or a body, and then people start throwing money about, and all of a sudden they disappear.
Yeah, it's just like, I've yet to hear of anyone who had a piece of a Sasquatch that they could produce. And the only report here in North America that I know, I actually met the investigator, John Worms, if I'm saying his name correctly. He's based in Canada. I forget what province. I want to say it's Ontario. But he actually did an interview with the late Paul Shibaga. And so the story goes, in a nutshell, that right around the time of 1941, when he was an immigrant to Canada, and he was about 17 years old, and he was their family was very poor, so they went moose hunting for food, and that's what put the food on the table. And according to the late Paul Shibaga, he did not have a license to do any hunting, and so all of this was like illegal hunting. But when you don't have any money, I guess that's what you do.
Yeah.
And he got separated from his hunting party, and he thought he saw in the bush a moose, so he took a shot at it, and apparently this thing took off, and he followed the blood trail. Lo and behold, it was not what he thought it was, and this thing was, he saw it dead, and his comment was, when he was interviewed, he was like, holy buckets. He says, I can't believe that something like this exists on this planet, and that the world does not know about it. But he was a teenager at the time and did not know whether this could be like a hairy person and that he could be prosecuted for murder.
Yeah.
So he pretty much kept the story to himself. But apparently what happened is that it appeared that his bullet was a direct hit into the spine of the animal, and that's what caused it. That's what caused the fatality of this Sasquatch that he observed. But he didn't have a camera. It's just his word. But having seen a videotaped interview of what he said, I have no doubt that such an event really took place as he said it did.
I mean, there is always, in some of the most compelling witness reports, Daniel, there is always an emotional aspect to the witness's reaction. Primarily because they are having to deal with a situation that, as far as they knew before that moment, was scientifically impossible.
Yeah, in fact, I've spoken to quite a few witnesses over the years, and one witness, a lady from Northern California in an area called Hoopa, which isn't too far from the Patterson-Gimlin film site, she told me, she goes, you know, I know, she says, I know what science says is out there, But then she also said, but I also know what I saw. And he says, there's two different things. And then another witness told me that he lived in Garberville, California, which is the northern part of the state. And he says, you know, I've lived and hunted here all my life. I grew up in this town, which is heavily wooded, and I've heard about Bigfoot all my life, and I always thought it was just a BS. And then one day, when he was patrolling the highways with his heavy equipment vehicle to move trees out of the way and so forth, in the Avenue of the Giants, and I think this was around 1994, he said he's had a sighting of one of these things that crossed the road. And he said in that one instant, he went from someone who thought the subject was total BS to someone who says, now I know they're there and I've seen one. So that's how it goes in terms of the witnesses. Many of the witnesses have no belief system in something like this because they think it's as real as a leprechaun or a unicorn or Santa Claus or whatever you want to call it. And then all of a sudden they see one with their own eyes, and it makes it very, very real.
Yeah.
The same with Bob Gimlin. He was with Roger Patterson, of course, when this famous incident happened in 67. And he had heard a lot of recorded testimony that Roger had rounded up about people saying that they had seen these things. And Bob was kind of like, okay, it sounds pretty interesting, but he says, I'll probably believe it if I ever see one. And needless to say, he did see one. And there's no question in his mind that these things are out there.
I mean, it's one of those cases, and there's a couple that we've discussed talking about that have always kind of been up there. And it's interesting when we're in regards to we're talking about corpses and intelligence and reactions, Daniel. One of my favourite stories is one of those that we seem to be learning more and more about it now we started really investigating it, which is obviously the infamous Ape Canyon attack.
Yeah, there's a fellow by the name of Mark Marcel who's
yes.
been the primary investigator in recent years of that case. And he kind of spurred me on to create a massive bibliography just on all the newspaper clippings about Ape Canyon. And part of the early story about Ape Canyon was there was a group of boys up in the area at the time too, from the YMCA or some boys group, that said they perpetrated this hoax or whatever on this group of minors. But on the surface, it doesn't take very long to have a thought process about that if they're throwing rocks at a cabin with a group of minors who are armed, that's a good way to get shot and killed real quick. And so I kind of doubt that anyone in their right mind would be playing a stunt of that magnitude and of that nature. Otherwise, they would know the immediate consequences that, you know, that someone is throwing rocks at their cabin. They open fire, and it's just like, yeah, they were defending their place because they were being attacked by these rocks, which proved to be teenage kids. And so that just never made sense to me, that story. But the story that they had shot and killed one of these apes, and it fell over the ravine, and the rest of the troop of that were in that area exacted revenge on the miners and attacked that cabin. And what's interesting about that whole story, at least according to Mark Marcel, is that after that incident, they pretty much gave up their gold claim. They never went back. I think they did go back once with the ranger to say, like, well, this is what all transpired, but after that they were done. And I guess it was that stressful emotional event that they called it quits. And not only did they see one and shoot one and kill one, but prior to that they had seen big tracks in that area that they didn't exactly know what was making them, but there's other people from that area who claim sightings, and that makes it even more interesting, is that they were independent of the Ape Canyon people that were there mining. Yeah. So Mark Marcel says he's working on a book, and he's already produced a booklet on the subject, but I'm hoping that he fleshes it out more and adds more pages and more pictures. But he did go back to the area and find the cabin that by a little using some detective work and lining things up. And sure enough, the remains of the cabin was there. And he retrieved nails and so forth. And other people have been up there as well.
Yeah. I mean, Mark's groundwork on this case is exemplary, Daniel, as you say, because I'd heard Mark's name mentioned here and there. And, you know, and I'll be the first to admit I didn't know a great deal about what he was actually looking into. And then obviously he appeared on the Small Town Monsters docu-series On the Trail of Bigfoot, which did a fantastic episode about Ape Canyon and featured Mark in it. So I think what's compelling about Mark's work on this case is the fact that he's essentially gone back to the source of the story and the historical data that's still available, which I find incredible that he was. It's one of those things, Daniel, that sometimes surprises me, that somebody just thinks, well, is it really true then? Let's make sure. And clearly Mark just found a you know, pardon the pun, found a gold mine of information about the whole situation.
Right. And the thing about Mark, I've met him one time in 2017 in the summer. But he has proven to be an excellent investigator in the sense that he does try to go back to the primary sources to find out the information about a story. And since that time, he and I have worked on other cases together. The Five Heights incident, where one of these things ran into a sign and bent it. And we followed up on that case as much as possible. And that happened in the state of Washington. Yeah. In 1969. And but getting back to Ape Canyon, I asked Mark, because he had done more investigation than anyone I've ever known on that specific case. I asked him, do you think it really happened? And he says, yes. And I said, well, what is that based on? And he says, well, basically, you have a group of miners that basically abandoned their claim after this incident. And back in 1924, that was a kind of a hard thing to do, because that gold is a source of income.
Yeah. I mean, that surely alone says that something very frightening happened to those gentlemen in that cabin.
Yeah, it was probably a group of Bigfoot that came in, that they were just happened to be overlapping where the gold mining was taking place and where the Bigfoot were actually living. It was just one of those things where it was inevitable that an encounter would take place, and the fact that they felt that they were going to shoot one, that they did shoot one, and that they apparently killed one, the body was never retrieved. But that kind of tells you that that these things probably instinctively know that revenge will be had.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the other aspect of this is once again, we have local Native Americans who are very aware of what they know as, I believe they call them mountain devils, Daniel. So it was one of those situations where the area that these guys ended up in had a reputation for something being up there that would make people very aware that it didn't enjoy being disturbed.
Yeah, and in fact, the bibliography I put the biggest bibliography together on the Ape Canyon case, and there's no question that prior to that time that there were other things going on that were mysterious, and in one of my annotated notes about it, someone had, I guess, wrote to the newspaper and said that I had an incident in that area, but it was actually before 1900.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking into it, I ended up finding a very strange story about a chap that disappeared mountaineering in the area in 1950, and the witnesses claimed that all the evidence looked like something had chased him off the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, I forget the guy's name there, but I know
Yeah.
I know the case pretty well, and he said that the guy, well, they later found out, or it came out in the newspapers, that he was a very experienced skier, and this was not the sort of thing that this individual would be doing, and it seemed like he was making a mad dash for his life, and ended up paying with his life.
I mean, once again, you have a situation where an experienced outdoorsman, be you a hunter or a sportsman, if you go out and you're a skier, you're a hunter, and you know your terrain, you know your areas, you know what's around there. And that, it was one of those stories, like I say, Daniel, I was not aware at all until I was reading more about Ape Canyon recently.
Yeah, so I think the guy, I think the skier's name was Jim Carter.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
I think that's the guy's name.
Yeah, but he was with a group of people and got separated as well, didn't he?
There again, and it's just like it's that separation factor that always seems to trigger incidents.
I mean, the other aspect of Ape Canyon is, and it'd be interesting to get your take on it, Daniel, because it was initially reported in, I believe that it was the Oregonian, I think was the original newspaper that carried the story, because they came out and spoke about it straight away, didn't they?
I think, to my memory, they spoke with the ranger first,
yeah.
And then somehow I guess it got leaked to the press, and then the press picked it up. But there was at least minimum of 24 newspaper articles and follow-ups on that specific case, with all sorts of differing opinions about what had exactly taken place. And I guess you could believe, since it happened so long ago, I guess you could believe whatever you'd like, but I tend to default back to what the miners claimed to have happened, that there were these hairy apes that were in the area, and this is what happened. There was also spiritual connotations that Fred Beck wrote about in his book, I Fought the Apes of Mount St. Helens. I think that was the name of the title of the book. And he kind of, I guess what you would think of at this point in time is that maybe he was trying to make sense of this whole thing. He obviously, Bigfoot wasn't coined yet. He probably didn't know that these could really be real things. And he kind of thought maybe they were just kind of ghostly manifestations or something like that, because he does talk about spiritualism and spirits and stuff like that in his book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that I've not stumbled across that explanation, Daniel, more than I have than very rarely mentioned, is that what if some of these experiences are people seeing ghosts of ancient primates? Because if people can see the ghosts of people, why can't they see the ghosts of animals?
That's always a possibility. I mean, that's always a possibility, but I have no expertise in that area, so I couldn't really offer you an opinion that would be worth anything.
Well, that's brutally honest and very humble of you, Daniel. I appreciate that. I think it's just, I certainly wouldn't, it's not one of those one size fits all explanations at all, because there are countless stories where that explanation just would fall apart under any scrutiny,
right?
But it just surprises me. But then again, I suppose if you're not expecting to see a Bigfoot, you're not really bothered whether it's a real one or the ghost of one,
right? And it's just like the thing about it, if it's altering the physical environment, and by that I mean if it's leaving tracks,
yeah,
and the tracks are sunk 1 inch deep into the ground, it kind of suggests to the rational person that you're dealing with a physical being. At least to me it would.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, that alone would discount that in the vast majority of experiences and witnesses.
Yeah.
I mean, the other aspect of Ape Canyon is, obviously, I know you've mentioned his name there. The criticism is always put that Beck's version, when it reappeared in the 60s, is a little bit different to what he said in 1924, Daniel.
Well, I think maybe he was trying to make sense of it. And it's just interesting that he would even write a booklet, because it wasn't really a book. It was more of a booklet. It wasn't that many pages.
Yeah.
A very rare publication, by the way. But it just, he did speak about spiritualism and spirits and stuff like that. And I guess to me, he was trying to make sense of what had happened at that time period in his life.
Oh, absolutely. I suppose whatever way you look at it, you know, you have to deal with that for the rest of your life.
Right.
You know, and I've seen countless interviews with people, Daniel, who have had real emotional, you know, I've seen hunters interviewed who've said, yeah, that was it. I put my guns away and I've never been back. And that, you know, when somebody loves something that much and they're so scared to return to something they love, that alone compels me to think something very odd's happened to that person.
Right, right. And it's just, I take it at face value from the original newspaper clippings, and I put a lot of stock into Mark Marcel as an investigator because, like I told him over the phone, I said, you know, you're one of the best investigators I know of presently in the field because you're taking things down, right down to the metal, in the sense going back to primary witnesses, which is the best thing to do, rather than just rely on secondhand information.
Oh, 100%, I agree. I'm desperate to speak to Mark at some point, so hopefully I'll be able to do a proper conversation with Mark, and we'll dive really into what he's uncovered and the evidence that supports, you know, a lot of people's opinion that something very strange happened to those men in that summer in 1924.
Yeah, I look forward to his book, but I'm not certain when it will come out.
Yeah, well, none of us have got any excuse not to finish any jobs off now, Daniel.
Yeah.
there's another notable case that occasionally pops up. It seems to go through a cycle of being fashionable. Is Bosberg, I think most people know it as a specific individual, don't they?
Yes, the Bosberg incident from December of 69. And one thing that is very evident is that two people who have some sort of expertise in footprints and anatomy and anthropology, the late Dr. Grover Krantz and the still living Dr. Jeff Meldrum, analyzed those footprints or castings, and both were of the opinion that the tracks were made by a living being based on the anatomy or the physical appearance of the track. And, you know, they were able to say, like, oh, this is where the bone structure is, and this deformity and the bulges are happening in the proper place. Meldrum and Krantz did have a difference as to what was the cause of the deformation, but they were both in agreement that what left the tracks was a real living foot, not something that was manufactured. And Hinden was involved in that, and so was Marx, but Marx had a more of a colorful reputation as a hoaxer. And so that a lot of people have written off Bosberg for the very reason that Ivan Marx was associated with it. And by the way, I met Ivan Marx in summer of 1990, and quite the character. But I believe what Rene said. He said, we followed these tracks. We were driving their vehicle, and the tracks right there on the side of the road, at least part of them. And they counted, I think, about 1,069 tracks. And that Rene pulled his movie camera out and shot footage of the tracks in the snow up in Baltimore, Washington, which is the northeastern part of the state. And that he said there was one portion where the tracks seemed to come together and there was yellow coloring in the snow. It was his impression that whatever stopped had urinated at that point. And that he said he looked back and he says, I probably wish I would have collected that urine, knowing that maybe it might be of value later on. But the tracks, what those series of tracks, they ended up going back into Lake Roosevelt, which is a dam. And there was a portion of that area where there was, I think, a boat ramp. And this was reflected in many of the newspaper clippings that were from that time period, and it was someone other than Renee, other than Ivan Marks, that was contacted by the newspaper, stated that I think it was part of the law enforcement that went out and looked. They said that whatever was there seemed to slide right into the frozen water using its feet as skis, and just seemed to one big slide mark right down that boat ramp into the frozen water. So you tell me, if a man is doing this as a hoax, that what would it take for someone to be so hoax-oriented that part of the scheme would be to go into freezing water that might even kill you? This doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think that's one of the aspects, you know, because Bosberg's probably better known as the Cripplefoot case, isn't it? So,
right.
But which I think does it, a bit of a disjustice, because I think, like you've just touched on, there are aspects of this case that very rarely get mentioned. That's a key part of it for me, Daniel, because not many people know that it seems to end in this icy plunge. Everybody just assumes these footprints stop.
I think the majority of the Bigfoot community stays on the surface, where they want to see the glossy pictures, the footprints in the snow, the castings, the drawings on the castings as to where the bones should be. And then they come up with their own opinion about what they think it is, whether it's real or not, not knowing the intricacy of that case and the details behind it. And that Renee, as one of the chief investigators of the time, put his stamp of approval. And he basically said, he says, I'm pretty confident that those tracks were made by Sasquatch.
Yeah.
And very, and it's just like whatever was leaving those tracks, I think they were like 17 inches long or in that neighborhood. That is a really, really big foot. And you can just imagine the size of the animal connected to that foot.
Mm, yeah. I mean, it's one of those strange ones, you know, I've touched on it before, Daniel, as well. It's one of those where there seems to be a real big flap because, I mean, anybody who was anybody seemed to descend on the town for the case because, it, you know, like you say, that time of year. And that's the other aspect about, would somebody really be wandering around in sub-zero temperatures hoaxing people?
It just doesn't make sense. It just way off the beaten Bigfoot track. And what's interesting about that case, that many of the well-known investigators of the time descended that area. There was John Green was there, Rene de Hinden was there, Dr. Grover Krantz was there because of Rene de Hinden. Roger Patterson showed up. Dennis Jensen showed up, who was a sidekick of Roger Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Burke was there. And there was quite a few other lesser-known Bigfoot investigators that went to that area hoping that they could finally find the Sasquatch. It didn't happen, but it just showed you that they were all taking the matter quite seriously because they went to investigate.
Yeah. I mean, it is also one of those because, I mean, once again, you've mentioned him, Ivan Marks is involved. And I know Marks's reputation precedes him in this field, like certain other notable others who seem to have started out with the best intentions, but I think perhaps got their eye turned a little.
He faked, there's probably very little doubt that he faked several Bigfoot films. And I think maybe he saw the success that Roger Patterson was having with the Patterson-Gimlin films, that he thought if he couldn't get a real Sasquatch on film, that he would fake it.
Mm.
And I guess he faked it in Washington, and apparently his film from Alaska, too, which I think he's got three or four of them that are probably the first thing that one does when they look at those films is blush by the fact that who would be so gullible as to be taken in by these, but quite a few people were.
Mm. Well, I think it's difficult sometimes, Daniel, because it's frustrating to not get that lightning in the bottle with, you know, footage. There are rare occurrences where excellent footage has been caught. Not much on the to compare to the Patterson-Gimlin film. But I think often there's a frustration to try and convince people by creating footage that what you've seen is real, because I spoke to Ken Gerhardt a couple of months ago, and he had just released a book about Bigfoot, The Essential Guide to Bigfoot, and he mentioned someone else that often gets overlooked was a gentleman called Paul Freeman.
Yeah, I think Paul Freeman, the thing about Paul Freeman is that the same thing in the UFO field, that a lot of these so-called contactees or eyewitnesses, long-term eyewitnesses, would be better off in just reporting what they initially saw, which is probably real, and they got a touch of fame and attention that they realized that they wanted more, and they couldn't produce more, so the best way around that was to fake information. So Paul Freeman, unfortunately, may have seen real evidence, but I think it's compounded by a lot of fake evidence, too, that he's presented. I guess Dr. Jeff Meldrum is still of the opinion that the great majority of what Paul Freeman found over the years is real. But then if you look at the stuff that Paul Freeman has collected in favor of the Sasquatch, it goes from Polaroid pictures with the sun present, because that's what the newspaper stated, to a couple of videotapes of Bigfoot, numerous Bigfoot tracks, handprints, knuckle prints, a butt print, hair samples. And so with all of that data being collected, or all of that evidence being collected, you would have to say Paul Freeman is the most successful Bigfoot hunter in the world. And then that's the thing you have to use your common sense about. It's just like, how can that be? It just, the common sense notion is that that doesn't make sense, that Paul Freeman is the most successful Bigfoot. It just never made sense, because I met the man in June of 1989, and by then he was grossly overweight and using a cane to walk. Oh. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. So you mean to tell me that someone of these sizes and proportions who has a hard time walking is finding all the best Bigfoot evidence? And obviously it must be coming right off the side of the road. So you have to wonder, like, where does the rubber meet the road with Paul Freeman?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's probably a good synopsis of what happened. Like you say, I think, you know, it's one of those started with the best intentions and then just couldn't stop.
Right. Right. And I think ufology has the same scenario, where there's people that may have had a real experience, but they liked it so much, the attention that they received, that they had to come up with more. And there's probably, in fact, I could see them in my mind, but I don't remember their names right now. But I guess the guy in Switzerland, I forget the guy's name right now, but he'd claim multiple UFO photos, and maybe there was one real one and the rest of it he faked. And I guess his ex-wife said that she said that one of the photos she recognized as the trash can lid from their home. And so that kind of is kind of eye-opening.
Yeah, sadly, it will always attract. But then again, I was speaking to Micah Hanks, and I was saying, well, cryptozoology would not be the only subject that's ever suffered hoaxing, Daniel. You know, it happens in all forms of science of some description, you know, from chemistry to biology to archaeology to paleontology. There have always been fraudsters and hoaxsters.
Yeah, and in fact, two of the famous people, and this was many years ago, Fleischmann and Pons, about cold fusion.
Yes.
And the rest of the scientific community reacted like, they said, well, wow, if you can do cold fusion, this would solve all of the world's problems with energy. And when they tried to replicate what they had seemingly created in the laboratory, no one was capable of doing it. And so there is a case of two people that are part of the scientific community committing fraud.
Yeah, but once again, it always, and like I said, my point was, it always seems that hoaxing always gets thrown at the 14 subjects like cryptozoology, ufology, and it really sticks, Daniel, and yet in other aspects it sometimes just disappears and people just don't want to talk about it, which I think is more to do with the fact that they're classed as proper subjects and proper science, and it's best everybody just moves on and forgets about everybody thinking they did it.
Right, and that's probably true to a certain extent.
I'm perhaps tarring too many people with a brush there, but you get my general drift, Daniel.
Yes.
So, I know one of the aspects that I'm always interested in is in regards to more recent reports. You know, I know we've touched on there seems to be a plethora of things out, you know, all over the place these days. But has anything kind of come across your radar in the last sort of year or two, Daniel, of a really compelling modern experience, modern witness sighting?
Well, this was an individual who declined to have his name used, but he's in the financial service industries, and somehow I got wind of him, of his information. He had a sighting because he was a hunter. And his hunting license in the state of California said that he had to hunt in the eastern part of California. Mm-hmm. And I guess this was for deer, the way I remember it. And I want to say this probably happened around 2012 or somewhere in that area. And I interviewed him. We did a videotaped interview because I thought the case was so compelling. And I happened to be in the right area at the right time, up in the Bay Area. And so he agreed to meet myself and a colleague after work to talk about what he had witnessed. And he said prior to all of this, he says, I never really thought that people took this subject seriously. He goes, I thought it was something like Santa Claus or something like that. But he said he was out hunting in the eastern part of California, but in northeastern California, and that he saw one of these things in a group of trees, and that it looked at him and it bolted off, and he said it looked like it moved as fast as a deer. It was just gone just as fast as he had seen it. And he said after that, he says, I think he expressed in the videotaped interview that we did with him that it was like someone peeking underneath the Christmas tree and opening the presents before it's Christmas Day. And he says, you don't need to tell me these things are out there because I know, because I've seen one with my own eyes. And we interviewed him, did a videotaped interview. And there was no question by the time I wrapped up that interview with him that such an event really took place, and that this was a sighting by this individual. And it's just the rarity of the creatures is what makes it kind of exotic, in the sense that why is it that only so few people see them? Well, think about it. Just about everyone I know of in my city, Los Angeles, I could probably go door to door and say, like, have you ever seen a cat? Have you ever seen a dog? Have you ever seen a deer? And the answer on all three questions is probably yes. But if you were to start talking about much rarer animals, such as a wolverine in North America, they might say that, no, I've never seen a wolverine. I don't even know what one is, but yet they exist. There might be, for the sake of art, in fact, biologists don't even know the real number. There might be, at best, maybe 3,000 wolverine in all of North America. And so that's why they're sighted so infrequently. And so the less the population of an animal, the less likely it is that you'll see them. And people just have a hard time wrapping their head around that concept.
Yeah, I mean, there's a prime example that I can think of straight off the bat, Daniel, and it's only because I was reading an article about it the other day. Are Fisher cats, and most people in North America have no idea what Fisher cats are.
Yeah.
And yet they grow to enormous. These get to, you know, what, 5 foot long? I think in some cases they're enormous.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's just, I think people have made up in their own minds what reality is and what reality isn't. And it's more based on their own belief system than what really exists in nature. And that's probably how a lot of people just conduct their lives. They have this belief system, and that belief system is in place. And if they were to see a Sasquatch, it kind of shatters that belief system.
Yeah. I mean, I often find it perplexing when people experience remarkable things in a variety of fields, Daniel, and yet sometimes they will try and explain it away with sometimes an explanation that's more ludicrous than the possibility of what they've seen being real.
Yeah, it's just, if you were to see a Bigfoot in the woods, that's probably what it is. It's probably not someone running around with a gorilla costume, and it's just like, because there they expose themselves to the risk of being shot at and killed.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like a suicide march. And that's the only reason someone would proceed to do something like that, because it just does not make good, smart sense to be running around in the woods with a gorilla costume.
Yeah, which is, once again, another situation where you just think, well, anybody doing that, as you touch on, is taking their lives in their hand. That alone is, once again, hoaxing is it can kill you.
Exactly. I totally agree with that, especially someone who is putting on a costume to impersonate a Bigfoot.
I've forgotten the gentleman's name who ended up getting run over pretending to be Bigfoot.
Yeah, that was, I don't know his name either, but I guess he was trying to impress people, ended up getting killed. And it wasn't really widely reported, but that's what happened, was the guy that dressed up as a gorilla, as a Bigfoot, tried to cause people to have sightings of a Bigfoot. And instead, he got hit by a car, and that was the end of him.
Yeah. Tragic, and a prime example of situations. You know, all the fields are filled with stories of, you know, investigators just getting completely out of the depth, and the same applies to hoaxes in such instances, Daniel.
Well, speaking of hoaxes, talk about October 20th of 1967 with Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin. If you say, for the sake of argument, that what they filmed or what Roger filmed was just some guy in a costume that is non-related to them, in the sense that they were not part of the same party, that someone was trying to perpetuate a hoax on them, that probably wouldn't have been a good idea, because both of them had rifles. And had they felt they needed to shoot it, they probably would have shot. And it's just not a good recipe for success.
Absolutely. And also...
And that case, the Patterson-Gimlin case, which is by far the most celebrated Bigfoot sighting in all of history, is so compelling. It's just ridiculous, in the fact that here you have two eyewitnesses, you have a known location, you have the names of both of the witnesses, so there's no anonymity there. The location has been seen by quite a few prominent investigators and could still be seen today. What was walking on the sandbar left tracks that were very deep in the ground, that were not only filmed by Roger Patterson, but were filmed after the fact by other people who were independent of Roger and Bob, who made plaster of Paris castings and photos of the tracks. And so that's the evidence that's in favor of that case, is that everything, if it were a crime scene, everything that you would want to be in place was in place. Multiple witnesses, a film, say it were a bank robber, a film of the suspect that is fleeing the scene. So there's, but his tracks are in the ground, and then you make plaster of Paris castings of the tracks. And then the fact that the film has withstood analysis to this very day is just speaks volumes to the fact that what you see on that film is a real living Bigfoot. And so if you were to take it rather than wade through all the complexities of the case and just get down to the brass tacks, the argument would go as such that if what you see in that film is a man in a costume, then surely it can be duplicated, but no one to date has been able to duplicate what you see in that film. That right there is the proof in the pudding. If it's a fake, you've duplicated. So why duplicated it?
I've seen a couple of attempts and they look hilariously bad. They're awful.
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the BBC came over to the United States to attempt, I forget the name of the production, but they came over to try to discredit the matter, and their attempt didn't look anything close to what you see in the Patterson-Gimlin film. And then later, National Geographic took the suspected hoaxer, Bob Hieronymus, and put him in a costume. And again, it was so pathetic that only a short portion of the film that they shot ended up on YouTube, not the entire. I guess they were so embarrassed by what they produced, they just kind of backtracked on the whole thing.
Absolutely. I'll tell you the other aspect of it as well, Daniel. If you're going to hoax it, why would you make it harder for yourself and say, let's make a woman?
Yeah, it's just everything about it just does not make sense.
Because that's
And
it.
if
That's one of those things that people that's once again the general consensus. I would suggest rather that if you ask the average person in the street, they'll tell you that's a male.
Right, because they don't see the subtlety of the breasts that are there. And the breasts would obviously suggest that it's probably a female, and or the common sense approach to it would be that what you're seeing there is a female. And it's just incredible in terms of at the time, say if you were thinking about faking, it doesn't seem like someone would fake something as a female for a monster because there's no masculinity to it. There's no monster masculinity to making it female. And it doesn't make sense to make it a female if that were a fake. You'd want to make it a male. And then the other aspect that's very troubling is that this, if you were to argue that it's fake or a hoax, that why would they film in broad daylight where you could see everything? This does not make sense.
I mean, the
And
other.
to the
Go on, sorry, Daniel.
To this day, Bob Gimlin holds firm, and he's still living. And I've interviewed him a couple of times and have been around him many times. And to this very day, he's still of that opinion that what he saw was a living, breathing Bigfoot right before his very own eyes.
Yeah, he's never wavered in that conviction to this day.
And neither did Roger before he died. And Rogers told the Bigfoot investigator Peter Byrne, he says, because there was so much ridicule about his film, that he says, looking back, I wish I just would have shot the damn thing. So the whole matter could have been brought to settled back in 67, but Roger made a pact with Bob Gimlin that never to shoot unless it was a life or death situation.
And I mean it is like you say everything you've touched on. I mean the other aspect of this, Daniel, as well is that I love monster movies, always have done since I was a kid. So I've seen all the great and good and quite a lot of really bad monster films from the 40s and 50s and 60s. And Whenever anybody said, "Oh yeah, that's just how special effects were in that those days," I just laugh my head off because they clearly have not watched any films made about monsters before 1967 backwards, because there's nothing comparable in the slightest.
Well, the late gorilla costume person, Johannes Brahe, who worked in Hollywood, came from a different country, Hollywood, California, for those readers in the UK or listeners in the UK who don't know state that, is that he was interviewed on a documentary called The Mysterious Monsters before he passed away.
Yes.
And I passed away from in a plane crash. But he said that, in essence, he had looked at the film and he said, if that is a fake, if that is a man in a gorilla costume, he said, that is the best ever I've ever seen. And this guy was in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember once hearing Arthur C. Clarke dismiss the footage by saying that they'd replicated the quality in 2001. And if anybody's seen 2001, and he's talking about the ape men, right, I defy anybody to say that that looks even comparable, even, you know, even if you've had a few shandies. Daniel, they don't look anything alike.
It's kind of like comparing night and day.
Yes.
And there might be a small portion of society might say, well, night and day are exactly alike, which obviously is not so. Mm. But there would be people that would take that position. But yeah, Space Odyssey 2001 and the PG film are worlds apart. And at the time, that 2001 film was supposed to be the best technology they had at the time.
Yeah.
And it pales compared to the PG film.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen that interview with that gentleman you referred to. I think he was South African. It really does ring a bell, because I watched that documentary recently because it's on YouTube.
I don't think he's from South Africa. Oh. I think he was more from, like, with a last name Prohaska, I would say, if anything, Czechoslovakia, Poland, or one of those countries.
I'm going to have to rewatch it because I remember seeing that interview and I know exactly what you're talking about, so I'm going to rewatch that now.
his name was, before he passed on, Johannes Prohaska.
Right.
And probably German, Polish descendant, but I think there's probably a Wikipedia entry on him as well.
Yeah.
And he had done a lot of costumes, played gorillas in such notable shows as I Love Lucy and so forth. And like I said, he saw the film, the PG film, and he just basically said, if that is a man in a costume, that is the best I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, the other direct comparison is Planet of the Apes came out the year after. That's clearly people wearing makeup as well, you know, and that's a Hollywood blockbuster.
And they said one of the guys that was responsible for creating the Planet of the Apes, Chambers, John Chambers, who's now deceased as well, he was interviewed in the book The Mysterious Monsters. He didn't make it onto the film, but he made it in the book. And he said that he had nothing to do with that. He says that has nothing to do with me. So he made a disclaimer then that he was not associated with the PG film. And later, the late Bobby Short, who ran the Bigfoot Encounters website, went up to interview him, John Chambers, before he passed away at a health care facility, a senior health care facility. And he also, again, said that he had nothing to do with that. And it wasn't anything that he had anything to do with.
Yeah. Because if you're that, this is the other aspect to it, Daniel. If you're that good, you could write your own check. You'd be the most in-demand special effects person in the world.
Exactly. So if Roger was that person, why would he not go to Hollywood and say, like, hey, this is what I can do, and it'll be fantastic? He never did that.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Daniel, listen, it's been absolutely brilliant chatting with you and covering a few cases and getting to know you a bit better. So, where's the best place everybody can keep up to date with you and find out about your work and more what you do?
Well, we go to bat every month with the Bigfoot Times newsletter that is mailed out in by the United States Postal Office all over the world. And you could just go to www.bigfoottimes.net, not as the website. And if you want to come on board with the Bigfoot Times, it's very affordable. And like I said, it's the only newsletter that's in existence to, and is in existence today as a physical paper newsletter. And so to me, that speaks volumes as to the quality of the newsletter.
Absolutely, and it's like you say, it's out regularly. It will. I would imagine you've got members still all around the world, Daniel.
Yep, and we have members in the UK too.
Good. Well, you'll be getting another one soon. Don't worry about that. Right. So, Daniel, thank you again for your time today. It's been a real pleasure. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. It's been wonderful to speak to you. So, I would just like to
It's
say.
been nice. It's been nice talking to you, and it's just let's just hope that other aspects of the world can be greatly improved with what's going on.
Absolutely, I concur entirely with that. You and yours take care. Thank you for your time, Daniel.
Okay. Bye-bye.